Hello, everybody, and welcome to Comedy Film Nerds episode 285, a little bonus ep this week.
Special themed episode. We're going to do cult films, and I'm really excited about our guest today. And one of the reasons, too, is occasionally we get guests in the garage that I've actually been a fan of before they actually came in to be a guest. And ladies and gentlemen, I'm just going to go out and introduce him immediately, filmmaker Adam Rifkin.
Hello. That's me.
Now, the first movie I saw of yours, we shared a manager many years back, and I remember the manager always saying like what Adam Rifkin was doing. I was like, oh, you know, he's writing Jumanji 2. And I'm like, are you trying to tell me something that I need to step it up? And
why can't you be more like Adam?
Yeah, why can't you be more like Adam and make more money for this company? And the first movie I saw of yours that I absolutely loved was The Dark Backward.
Well, thank you very much.
And it was one of those movies that you're watching, like, I'm watching this movie going, I love this movie, and I can't imagine how it got made. Like, because it's got so many, you have literally a three-armed comedian.
Right.
Wayne Newton.
Right.
Some very large women.
Yes.
And Bill Paxton.
Correct. And James Caan, and Rob Lowe, and Judd Nelson, and Laura Flynn Boyle.
Yes.
It was a tough movie to get made for a long time until, I'll tell you exactly how it happened. It was the first script I ever wrote, and I didn't know anything about how Hollywood worked. I was out here from Chicago, which is where I'm from.
Oh, nice. Where in Chicago?
Oak Park is where the family all grew up, is where the family's all from for several generations, and then for various years, different, like I went to middle school in Arlington Heights, and then I went to high school in the city, and just all over the place.
I grew up in Evanston.
Okay, great. Yeah, all my friends were from Evanston. Nice. From my high school. But the family for several generations all sort of were based out of Oak Park. Mm-hmm. But that house sold, and now my grandmother moved downtown. But anyway, it was the first time I ever wrote a script, so I didn't know to take certain things into consideration, like, is this movie financeable?
<You know? laughs> Let's just make a movie.
Right. Yeah. I just wrote what I thought would be a cool movie. I also wrote what I thought might stand out from the crowd. I knew I would never be able to get a lot of money to make a big movie. So I figured if I write a small movie, but it had kooky, crazy ideas in it, it hopefully would stand out, just that the production value would be its originality. Mm-hmm. So I wrote it and couldn't get it funded at all. And then I met Brad Wyman, who,
mm-hmm. yes,
our
mutual manager.
That's
yes.
Right, manager. And Brad was working for an old-time producer named Elliot Kastner, who was cranking out lots of low-budget movies at the time. And we tried to get him, and he read the script, loved it. He said, let me try and help you get this made. I want to produce it. So we went to Elliot, tried to get it funded. Elliot wouldn't fund it. At the time, I was dead set on making it in black and white. That was foolish. I mean, eventually...
young filmmakers.
Yeah, exactly. You know, interestingly enough, I don't think that would be as difficult today. There's not the stigma of black and white today, because today's young moviegoers, they didn't grow up with black and white being a residual of a past.
Right.
Now, black and white is just a stylistic choice you could choose to do.
You'd get more resistance by saying, I want to shoot on 35mm film.
Without question. Without question. Now, I mean, black and white is just a cool, you know, setting on your app.
That's
you know?
That's a great point that they didn't, like, we grew up like, oh, there was pre-color. There was the black and white era,
sure.
And then the color era. So why go back? And there was all this
That's what we all thought of, and all the financiers thought of at the time. But now I don't think there would be that at all.
Yeah, if you came in and it was an interesting film that what they thought was marketable, and
yeah.
And you're just like, mm-hmm. This is the stylistic choice I want to make, they go, okay, great.
Exactly. Now, Brad was buddies with and grew up with the whole Brat Pack all during their heyday. And he gave the script to Judd Nelson. And Judd Nelson read it and said, I want to play the lead, the stand-up comic who grows a third arm out of his back. And I was dead set against it. I thought, Judd Nelson is the tough kid from Breakfast Club, mm-hmm. and there's no way. I mean, the character is very meek and nerdy and vulnerable. I just couldn't believe that he could pull it off. But he demanded that he audition for me because he wanted to prove to me that he could play it.
And still your first film.
First film.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, actually, I had made another film prior, Elliot didn't fund The Dark Backward, but he did fund my first film, which is called Never on Tuesday.
Got it.
That got the ball rolling. But still, it was very difficult to make Dark Backward going. He auditioned for it, and I believed him. I thought, okay, he's an actor. He can pull this off. He can play a tough guy, and he can also play a total geek. So I was thrilled. So Brad, immediately when Judd Nelson signed on, and Judd Nelson could get movies funded at that time, it was easy to fund the movie because suddenly a movie star was attached.
Right.
So the company that funded it, which no longer exists, was a company called RCA Columbia Home Video. I mean, obviously Sony Pictures exists, and they own Columbia Pictures, and it's a different entity now. But at that time, there was a division called RCA Columbia. They were cranking out small
movies. It's an accounting shell game.
Correct. They made a splash with Sex, Lies, and Videotape at that time, and then funded a whole bunch of other little movies. And they didn't even read the script. Judd Nelson, this tiny budget, green light. You know what I mean? Now, eventually, they saw the movie at the screening and hated it, of course.
But, that's so awesome. Wait, what the fuck did we give you money for?
That's exactly right. But prior to that, they just gave us the money and said, go make the movie, because on their spreadsheets... Were there spreadsheets in those days? Whatever they called them.
Ledgers.
Yeah, ledgers.
some old leather-bound book. Yeah. Right.
It said that Judd Nelson, with this budget, meant this much back. It was a no-brainer. Right.
And that ledger went in the safe.
Right. Yeah. So that's how we got the movie made. I eventually made it in color because we just couldn't get it made in black and white. But it's still, to this day, my sentimental favorite. Of all the movies I've made, I don't think I'll ever have the freedom I had making that movie. And... because it was my first screenplay and everything, it's a movie that means a lot to me, near and dear to my heart. So thank you for liking it.
Absolutely. It's a great movie. And if those of you film nerd fans who haven't checked it out yet, definitely check it out, The Dark Backward.
Yeah, I'm curious to see this because I remember when it came out briefly and I was like, wait, what? I was young. I was in college. I was just had been doing stand-up comedy couple of years and was like, what the fuck is this? Who's this guy? Like, what?
It's a bit of an oddball movie, but I mean, if the theme today is cult movies, I mean, I guess you could say I kind of wanted it to be a cult movie. I don't think philosophically, I don't think you can create a cult movie. Right. I think it has to happen organically. But I was so inspired by so many of the cult movies that I loved that I was hoping that it would be seen in those categories, and it has taken on a cult following.
I think it's funny that you say categories, and we're gonna start talking about some cult movies here. But I think that's, to me, you're right. You can't say I'm gonna make a cult movie.
Yeah.
But I think when movies fall into the cult category is when they don't fit in any other one.
It's good, right?
Or they could cut, they're a little bit of this and a little bit of that, but it doesn't. And so, like, maybe a mainstream audience is like, well, I don't get it. I thought this was going to be a whatever, a rom-com, and it's not, or whatever. Yeah. And then,
what's this, Repo Man?
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. Why are aliens taking cars? I don't like it, you know? But, but when it.
Show this movie in Russia.
Yeah, that's exactly. When you can't quite pin it down. And there is a unique charm to it or a quirkiness to it, then it's like it's great.
And it has it finds that audience that is really extra passionate about it.
Well, I made it as a movie that I would want to see. I mean, that to me was the criteria for me. I wrote a movie that I would love to see, and I directed it to be a movie that I would love to see, and that I knew were the kinds of movies that didn't get made all that often or often enough for my taste. I liked kind of offbeat films, you know?
I think it sounds simple what you just said, but it seems to me, and we talk about this a lot on the show, that like when we're like, what was this director doing? Why were they doing this movie? I don't think when a movie fails or it's a big studio thing necessarily, when it feels like there's many too many cooks, the director wasn't saying, do I want to watch this? Would I enjoy watching this? Because I'm assuming if you're a filmmaker, you're a film fan.
Of course.
You love going into cinemas. Yeah. You love when the lights go down and you're like, oh man, this is going to be awesome. So you obviously should be, it seems obvious, but too often it seems to be missed.
No.
That they're just like, oh, this would be good marketing or this will hit this demographic as opposed to, would I like this?
Well, you know what? It's the difference between the show half and the business half of movie making. A lot of people in the movie business are all about the product, and a lot of filmmakers in the movie art form are in it for the to make good movies, mm-hmm. and you kind of got to find a happy medium,
right.
you know.
Right.
And the reason that more movies don't get made purely for the art of it are because they don't make a lot of money, you know.
Right. Well, let's get into some. Absolutely. Let's get into some cult films.
Yeah, let's talk about. Some of the ones. Let's talk about a cult film that maybe inspired you.
Like, okay,
growing up, what did you enjoy?
Well, I'll tell you the movies specifically that inspired me to make my first film. And by the way, one of the most flattering things that has happened to me as I've as my career has evolved is that I'll read articles about cult films, and in the same article they'll cite films that were an inspiration to me, and they'll cite The Dark Backward as one of the films in the sort of list of cult films. And so to some people, it's now considered among those circle of films, and that to me is tremendously flattering. So some of the movies that inspired me were Eraserhead was very inspiring. I mean, directly inspiring of The Dark Backward.
And interesting, Eraserhead, too. It's not an easy movie to watch.
No, it's not.
It's a very difficult one to get through for a number of different reasons. Yeah. And but if you can get through it, it's one of those movies, too. If you can get through it, you feel like it's almost like you've a rite of passage as a movie watcher.
Sure.
You're like, yeah, I may not have understood it, but I watched the entire thing.
It's true. And I'll tell you, when I was growing up, I mean, that movie was still playing the midnight circuit. People don't really know now about the midnight circuit, but there was a thing that, called the midnight circuit, where movies that didn't have a place really anywhere else, they would find their niche playing midnight screenings around the country, and they'd play over and over. Like Rocky Horror Picture Show is the most famous example.
Right. Yes.
But there's a lot of movies that played the midnight circuit for years.
Well, they didn't realize Eraserhead was one of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Rocky Horror came out of that midnight circuit, and they were the only ones that sort of have remained. I mean, they still play it, I think, here at the New Art in Santa Monica in West LA. But I remember that as a kid.
I'm sure people still dress up and throw toast at the screen.
But I remember there was a bunch of them, a bunch of films that would go, oh, this is the midnight thing. And it was also sort of that was kind of the midnight was sort of. That was a sort of unofficial cult badge of honor.
Totally.
Like, well, you can't do Saturday matinee, but you're the midnight. So it's almost like,
it was cool. And people, I mean, you couldn't see many. I mean, home video hadn't really, you know, when midnight movies were at their heyday, it was the 70s and early 80s, and home video wasn't really as popular. I mean, it's a whole different world now, you know, with streaming and everything. But if you wanted to see some of these oddball movies, you had to go, you had to stay up till midnight and go see them at midnight screenings, you know? So that was one that definitely influenced me.
That's David Lynch's first film?
David Lynch's first film. And he made a lot of films that have and continue to influence me. I mean, I just am a huge fan of his. He's a truly original voice in film. Right. I mean, his movies are great, you know?
I remember, too, when Twin Peaks came out, like, it was like David Lynch's first TV series. Yeah. Everyone was going nuts over it. And
so
you know
great.
What? It was one of those things, too, where it was a great show, too. But again, studio meddling, they kept moving the time and the date, and, like, people couldn't find it anymore. Yeah. This was before DVRs.
Yeah. Wouldn't you love to have that, or now, like, on Netflix? Where Netflix just basically goes, okay.
Oh, man.
Yeah, can you imagine if David Lynch made a Twin Peaks deal back then?
Yeah.
You know, like, all right, well, it doesn't matter. We're going to, here's 13 episodes. People can watch them whenever they want.
That idea back then was completely foreign.
Didn't exist.
It was like in Star Trek.
Yeah. None of it existed.
Yeah.
That was like you'd see it in a Star Trek episode.
Yeah.
That kind of like, with the replicator.
Right.
Yeah.
What's another?
Terry Gilliam was a huge influence.
Oh, I love Terry Gilliam.
Brazil.
Yes.
Obviously Monty Python, his animation in the Monty Python series. Mm-hmm. But all those Python movies, but all Gilliam's movies as well, like Brazil and Baron Munchausen and Jabberwocky. And I mean, huge influence.
Brazil is one of those, again, it's what we're talking about. Like, explain Brazil to somebody that hasn't seen it, or someone that's
good
just
luck.
Sort of a that's not a cult fan or a big cinephile. Explain to them. You're like, well, it's there's
not,
this.
Not to mention everything he went through with that movie, where he had to steal his own film print to get an award.
I was at a screening. I went to USC briefly in 84 and 85, end of 84, beginning of 85. And I saw some cool films screened there before they were screened anywhere else, and the directors would come and speak. David Lynch brought Blue Velvet there, which is amazing.
Oh, wow.
You know what I mean? bunch of cool films, and Dave and Terry Gilliam brought Brazil there, and he had to come twice because the first time he was about to turn on the projector, and the studio lawyers made him stop, and he was not allowed to show it in the current state that he wanted to show it in because it was in the middle of the legal battle
about the cut
and about the ending. So he then took the 2 hours that were meant to be for the film and just told all the stories about what he's been through on the movie. And of course, we all, you know, took his side.
Of course,
you see Lost in La Mancha, you realize a lot of the chaos that Terry Gilliam has experienced in his career, he creates himself. But as an idealistic young film student, you blindly take the side of the filmmaker.
The suits are keeping us down.
Right. But it was amazing. And then he came back like the next week and showed it. When he was allowed to show it, and it just blew us all away. We loved it.
The Criterion Collection of Brazil is fantastic. You can actually see, like, because they give you all the different cuts.
Yeah.
They give you the cut that Terry Gilliam made. That's the European cut.
Sure.
But then the American cut was supposed to be shorter, and that's where, like, well, no, I don't want to make it shorter, and that's where everything blew up.
Yeah.
So they cut a version for him, like the Love Conquers All version, it's called. That has a completely different tone and ending and everything from the actual film. And it's fascinating to watch because it's really jump cutty. It looks so sloppily put together. And like, well, wait, this can't be what a filmmaker would put together. So if you can literally see how a studio destroys a movie from start to finish, because you could see the actual version and then you could see what the other editors released. In fact, in one of the documentaries, it was... the American editors would call him and say, look, we're cutting this down and we're putting this ending here. And then Terry Gilliam would take the calls the first couple times. And then he just rolled his eyes in the interview and was like, yeah, eventually I just stopped taking the calls. You know, when one of the editors went, I'm trying to help you, then I'm done.
I remember watching Brazil on video, on VHS when I was in high school, maybe a couple of year or two after it came out, and just being, I watched it late at night and was just mesmerized by it. Like, just...
It's so beautifully creates this dystopic world, you know what I mean? And by the way, prior to that, the actual movie version of 1984 came out, which I also thought was a pretty good movie.
Yes.
You know, I don't know, I mean, have you seen it? The one with the Eurythmics soundtrack?
Yeah.
It's a pretty good movie. And he said in the when he was there speaking, he said that the movie that Brazil has been in the works for so long that it preceded that 1984 version. And then he watched that movie get made and finished and released, and there were so many similarities. He was worried that it was going to steal Brazil's thunder, and you could see a lot of it has a similar vibe to it.
Mm-hmm. Sure,
but it's totally different, obviously. But
yeah,
there were three.
Brazil wasn't based on a book either.
No, it was
George Orwell book. Yeah.
There were three movies that had a cult that grew, a cult status grew around when I was in high school, and when I was young, me and all my friends, when we would see films, we were totally unaware of if a movie was financially successful or not. We just knew that we liked it or we didn't like it, you know? I mean, now everybody knows.
You didn't have Variety delivered every day?
No. But now everybody in any part of the world knows what opened number one this weekend, you know?
Right.
What I mean?
They go Rotten Tomatoes or whatever.
Absolutely. Yeah. And they also sort of base their opinion of the movie sometimes on if it was successful or not, you know? But at that time, we didn't even think about it. And there were three movies that were, I subsequently had learned, were unsuccessful, but I loved them, and they were big influences, and they all now have huge cult followings. The Hunger, which came out when I was in high school.
David Bowie,
the Tony Scott movie.
Mm-hmm.
Blade Runner, which I didn't realize was a huge bomb at the time. I just thought, wow, this movie's great, you know? And then Road Warrior.
Another 100 versions of
that. Yeah, exactly. And The Road Warrior, we all thought these movies were so cool.
Road Warrior didn't make money?
I think The Road Warrior actually made more money than not. I think that was actually a successful movie. But those were three movies that in sort of our little vacuum of just being film geeks and loving movies, we felt we discovered those films and they were really cool films. And those also were big influences on me when I made The Dark Backward, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Blade Runner, I mean, we've talked about it before on this show, but Blade Runner is such an amazing... I just watched it again recently and was just so blown away by the vision of that film, the message that it's getting at.
I think they got most things right, with the exception of Atari still being around.
Very good point.
Yeah.
How'd they miss that
one? Yeah.
You could say the same thing about 2001 with respect to Pan Am.
Yes.
Yeah, that's right. Pan Am's in there. But Blade Runner was so, you know, I grew up in Chicago in the Midwest and everything. And when I moved here, and a buddy of mine moved to Koreatown. This is in the like mid to late 90s, before Koreatown was like sort of the hip spot. Mm-hmm. And there was this bar we used to go drinking at, and it was run by these Thai people. There was Latino guys there. There was like every ethnicity. And I went, oh, this is Blade Runner. Huh, like, you know what I mean? There's like someone from Vietnam. There's a, you know, there's
someone's got a robotic eye.
Yes. Someone's got fake snakes.
Yeah.
But it was like, and I was like, oh, I see what they did. They took the melting pot of LA, mm-hmm. which is very Latino and very Asian. And then, well, let's see what 40 years from now looks like.
Yeah.
And I remember the first winter I was here, when it was getting all cloudy and rainy, I was like, oh God, this is like Blade Runner. Like, you know, this is just, it's just the smog rain all the time, mm-hmm. and everyone's speaking weird languages. And it was so cool what they did.
I mean, to be fair, you would go into a restaurant and go, this is just like Blade Runner.
Yeah. Yeah. Everything.
Just everything. Like this library, this is just like Blade Runner.
Blade Runner. Everything should just be like Blade Runner.
Well, I love Blade Runner. You know, I actually have friends who are whose opinions I really respect, who are not into Blade Runner, but I love it. And
why are they not into Blade Runner?
I don't know. More importantly, how are they your friends?
I don't know. I have friends who are not into movies that I that just being one of many movies that I hold near and dear. I guess that's what makes horse racing. But
Well, let's talk about some other ones.
Cult classics.
Yes.
Absolutely.
We got to talk about Pee-wee's Big Adventure. Pee-wee's Big Adventure was Tim Burton's first feature film.
Mm-hmm. And, love that movie.
It's a fantastic movie. And you know what? My kids really liked it, too. It was one of those movies that, like, I can watch it without my kids and just still really enjoy it, and then my kids can really enjoy it, too. But you just see that vision that Tim Burton had. And you also see, when he worked as an animator for Disney, like, some of the, I think it's on one of the other DVDs that got released, I think, like Nightmare Before Christmas, it has his old short films on it that he did while he was in Disney. And those are the ones that helped him get funding to get Pee-wee's Big Adventure. And they're fantastic. There's one where he does like a Vincent Price animation.
Yeah, it's
animation.
Vincent. Yeah, it's phenomenal.
It's fantastic.
Yeah. You can see it on YouTube.
Yeah. And Frank and Weenie, too, the original short that later became a movie. But you look at like Pee-wee's Big Adventure, and it's the kind of movie that just, it captures everything so perfectly, of like this kind of outcast character, but a fun character. I wouldn't exactly call it an interesting story. He's just chasing his bike, but it doesn't matter. You're having so much fun watching this movie, and it's so different than anything that kind of had come out at the time.
Sure.
It was just really, really a fun film.
And a dynamite score. It was Danny Elfman's first score.
Great score. Yeah.
And also had great... all the other surrounding characters were great.
Fantastic.
Unique, but not... This is a tough thing to get right. Is, okay, we want quirky characters. We want to be kind of weird and out there without them seeing just either two-dimensional or dumb or cartoonish.
Right.
And they kept them rooted in just enough reality. They're over the top, but there's just enough reality that it's like, oh, it reminds you of, like, oh, I kind of remember meeting some weird guy at a restaurant that said something creepy to me or whatever. Yep. And like that were sort of based in that, to where it made the film likable, because it had just enough believability in it.
Right. And Paul Rubens, just everything from the script to the performances, just everything just gelled. And it was also the kind of movie where you saw that this was somebody's vision from start to finish.
Sure.
I doubt there was a note that said, you need to put Twisted Sister in it.
Right.
You know, there wasn't those weird, like kind of like, oh, this must have been the studio meddling to put this in. But it was just a really cool vision from start to finish. And I thought it was a great kind of debut for Tim Burton.
Phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it really, it kind of set the tone for how Tim Burton has always had a unique vision in every single one of his movies.
And like he makes movies about outcasts, basically. And what's interesting is, like, he almost makes it a genre. Like, this is the outcast that's really funny. This is the outcast that's, like, really sad and you have a lot of empathy for. This is the outcast that's the monster or whatever.
Right, right.
And he just, he does it a different way in each one of his films. I just want him to stop doing remakes. You know, more Pee-wee's Big Adventure, more less Dark Shadows.
All right, there's a movie I want to talk about on here. Where is it?
For those of you who don't know, we are referring to a list of cult titles.
Yes, that's what the big pauses are. Oh, I want to talk about The Omega Man, the Charlton Heston.
Fabulous.
One of these, that era of movies.
Love them.
Not the Will Smith,
though? No, not the Will Smith one. This is classic 70s dystopian, like everything's collapsing.
Sure.
Society, Watergate, Vietnam, it's all coming apart.
Yeah.
And then Charlton Heston, as in his defiant, you know, his defiant self, and there's so many wonderful things in there too. I referred to this movie when I made the Hello Junkie short film, which was a parody, Adam, of 70s cop shows.
Great.
And so Stryker's this tough as nails cop, and you know his girlfriend is this, you know, this black soul sister. And the actress, I said, watch the black woman in the Omega Man and how they interact.
She kicks ass.
She's a badass. Yeah. He's kind of a weirdo because he's been living alone for so long. He finally meets her and he's talking to that mannequin that he plays chess with.
Yeah.
And she's playing, she puts on some like funky music and he goes, it's your move. And she goes, I already made mine. Like, game on. Like, she's like, I haven't been with a man in a while and we're going to throw it down.
Yeah.
And then his defiant, like, you know, someone asked him, why do you still live here? It's where I live. It's where I used to live. It's where I'm going to live. And not Matthias nor any other son of a bitch is going to do anything about it. Like, he's just, it's classic 70s Chuck Heston, man.
From what I understand, Omega Man was the third sci-fi film he had made. There was Planet of the Apes. There was Soylent Green.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently, because those were both super successful, he produced Omega Man, or he wanted to be in on making all the money for the successful sci-fi movies with himself. And apparently, it was not a big success. It was not a big financial success. I grew up loving it. I think it's a great movie.
It was one of those films that
Anthony Zerbe was the head baddie. Zombie baddie.
That's interesting.
Get rid of all your old notions, all your old ways. Like, it was, I remember watching it on TV as a kid, and I remember just, it was like crazy. It was
still around. I mean, it still plays.
It was directed by a friend of mine's dad. His name was Boris Segal.
Oh, wow.
And Boris Segal was a big television director in his day, and directed a lot of TV movies too, and some movies. And Omega Man was one of his movies, and I love it.
I mean, where they come out at night and they shoot the fire at his house, and every day it's this crazy battle with them, and he's trying to find the serum or whatever, the antidote to the...
I wonder how many... I'm trying to think how many times I Am Legend has been made into a movie.
Well, there's the Vincent Price version.
Vincent Price one, yeah.
There's Omega Man.
And then there's the Will Smith one.
Right. And it's been ripped off countless times.
Right. Those are the official adaptations, the three.
Yeah, but that's a great one. And you talk about then Soylent Green is another movie.
Love it.
That, again, such heavy social commentary.
Sure, yes.
You know, and all of it. I mean, even Planet of the Apes.
You know,
totally.
Soylent Green had a really disturbing scene. I don't know if it was supposed to be as disturbing as it was, obviously, the ending. But the scene when they're scooping the people up into the, like, with the forklift.
Shades
like,
of Nazi concentration camps, of course.
It was incredibly disturbing as I'm watching this, because it just had all these connotations and the commentary on it. But it was weird because it was like a really slow thing too. It wasn't like going into a crowd and like shooting a bunch of people. It was like these slow trucks would slowly scoop people up and put them in the back. And you know, you would never see them again.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was just methodical.
Right.
Like institutionalized horror.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, like the government can do this.
And that's why this, I mean, in this sort of era of paranoia of the government, that's where a lot of this stuff came out of, you know, obviously. One of the reasons that I love the remake of Invasion of the Body Snatchers, mm-hmm. the version with Donald Sutherland.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think, first of all, I love the original as well. The original is, you know, the Red Scare. You know what I mean?
Yes.
It's all about it's all about that, you know, the Russians are coming, right? Yeah. But then the remake is all about mistrust of one's own government. And it's that sort of got that political 70s vibe. I just saw, they just had a screening at the Arclight of 3 Days of the Condor. You know, all those 70s, those great 70s political thrillers where you can't trust the government. Yeah.
They were basically, all those movies were saying you can't trust the government.
Yeah. Away from the window, please.
Yeah. All of the first hints at like, you know, if we mess with the environment, guess what? Yeah. Human race might not be around. Right. I mean,
man versus nature. Yeah. Man always loses.
Man always loses. Exactly. And it's like, I mean, that was the heavy 3 Days of the Condor. And,
great.
And just that, like, the global corporate, like, Rollerball.
Love it.
And 3 Days. Rollerball is basically like, oh, this is 3 Days of the Condor 30 years later whatever. Like, this is what happened. Because 3 Days of the Condor, it's this global thing. Oh, we need to start this war because we need the oil. And all. And Robert Redford's face of just like, what?
Yeah,
like,
and that movie is as relevant today as it's ever been. You
more
know?
So.
And it's that post-Watergate, post, you know all those assassinations through the 60s, mm-hmm. Watergate in the 70s, Vietnam War, all that stuff is what fed these paranoia, you know, of one's government movies, and you got great stuff out, great movies out of it. I mean, a lot of turmoil politically in real life, but that was a great cauldron for creativity for people who are wanting to make statements with their art.
You know? It's an amazing time what you're talking about because so all of the institutions were being either coming down or people were challenging them.
Yeah.
And that happened in Hollywood. The studios mm-hmm. were done. So then you had this sort of, you can make whatever you want. Everyone, and it was almost like you had to be challenging the system or you weren't.
You weren't cool.
You weren't
cool.
Right. Yeah. It was that simple. Yeah, you weren't cool.
Right.
And so, and now it's like, you know, you can challenge the system a little bit, but then, you know, they're going to just come down on you hard. And this way they won't.
Corporations own everything.
Yeah. And which is Rollerball. Mm-hmm. I mean, the like the John Houseman character in Rollerball is just this old white powerful guy who's, you know, telling Jonathan, you know, Jonathan E is a superstar and they're like, no, you're not.
Yeah.
You are a cog in the wheel. That's the same thing with 3 Days in the Condor. Go back. You had your little CIA job. You weren't supposed to hear this. Shut up.
Yeah. Yeah, you know? Exactly.
I always felt like Death Race 2000 was like a poor man's Rollerball.
Totally.
it's with a tenth of the budget.
Right.
Yeah, and a tenth of the actual metaphor.
Just like, we'll just sprinkle a couple in there. But mainly it's cool car chases.
Yeah,
cool
car chases. Let's Sly Stallone run over some people.
Yeah. Maybe we'll get a glimpse of Mary Warnoff naked.
Yeah, but that's what you're coming for is cars and boobs.
Mayhem.
Versus actual social commentary. Right.
But also out of that, too, I mean, another movie that I love that came out of that era was Network.
Oh, of course.
Network is terrifying.
Yeah.
Go watch it. It has everything it's we're living happened. Today. It has predicted it.
And it's worse now than ever. When it came out, it was seen as so outrageously satirical.
Yeah.
And now it has not only come to fruition, but beyond
what Paddy Chayefsky
could have ever imagined. That I will say, not to sound like I'm doing a shameless link, but the biggest inspiration for shooting the Warwicks was the movie Network.
See, that movie is, again, they're doing it over the top, and people are like, well, TV will never, back then they're like, well, this is crazy, TV's a little bad, it'll never get this bad. I to this day, the revolutionaries arguing deal points.
Yeah, of course.
Is fucking
genius.
It's
hilarious.
Genius,
yeah.
And it's like, that's they predicted reality TV.
Totally. Yep.
They predicted all of it.
Totally.
Just
now, let's talk about that a little bit. Your new film, Shooting the Warwicks, is you pretty much take on reality television and in its current form.
Right.
Now, I saw the trailer. I haven't seen the film yet. With a lot of your movies too, you set it up as it's a comedy, but it's not all a comedy in there. It's also a little bit, there's a couple thriller elements in there.
Tell us
like what was your vision for creating this film?
The basic idea of shooting the Warwicks is that a reality show producer has an idea for reinventing reality television. He feels it's all fake, that it's all staged, it's all phony. It's gotten to the point where nobody believes any of it anyway. So he wants to reboot reality by bringing reality back to it. And the way he wants to do that is he wants to put a family, he wants to star a family in his new reality show. But he says, well, what's the difference between reality and non-reality? Well, if you put a camera in somebody's face, they're going to be different in front of a camera. That just human nature. If you know you're being photographed, you're going to either be inhibited, or you're going to be much more exhibitionistic. It's going to change when there's a camera in the room. It just changes the context of everything. So he says, what if we take a family and we put them under surveillance without their knowledge? We hide cameras all over their home. We hide cameras all over their work. We follow them everywhere they go with a comprehensive surveillance team or series of teams. And if they don't know they're the stars of a reality show, they will be 100% authentic all the time. And because we are a nation of voyeurs, we will find it much more fascinating to watch them, you know, without it being staged, than if we were to concoct something in a writer's room.
Right.
And so the network loves it. So he picks a family at random. He makes them think they've won a vacation to Hawaii. So when they're out of town, he rigs their home with cameras, everywhere with cameras. And when they come home, he puts them under surveillance. And now, you know, real life is going to be much more interesting than staged reality. And what he quickly figures out is real life is boring. Of course, right? There's nothing dramatic about it. So he rationalizes that because conflict is the cornerstone of drama, if he can just inject a little bit of conflict in their lives, not a lot, just a little, it will, however they react, will make it a little more interesting. And he rationalizes away that this is not blowing his conceit. And so what happens is he starts to do that and it starts to work. And so he and the network start to realize, well, if we put a little more conflict in, anyway, it goes to very, very dark places as he is, you know, as his meddling is ruining this family's, their lives. But he rationalizes yet again that it will all be forgiven when the shows air and they're rich and famous. But before that happens, things go down the rabbit hole and it gets a little crazy. It gets out of his control.
What's the status? Is this out yet?
It's out. It came out theatrically earlier this year. It is now available on VOD.
Our friends at Vega Baby distributing.
Okay, that's right. That's
Vega Baby is distributing. It's also available on disc, but you can watch it right this moment on VOD, or you can order the disc and all the different platforms, iTunes, Amazon, you know, Vudu, whatever, you know. And I would love for people to check it out and let me know what they think.
That sounds awesome.
Absolutely. So, okay, and we have an ad read.
Boom.
This is Touch of Modern yet again.
Oh, I love Touch of Modern.
They're awesome. Now, as you, I'm sure you know, if you check last week, this week is going to be some different merchandise there.
Well, here's the thing. I was just browsing. That's why I love this site. It has everything. So I ride my bike a lot.
Sure. You're in Santa Monica. Why wouldn't you?
Well, there's no reason to be in a car.
Yeah. You're not an animal.
Yeah. I'm not some sort of savage riding around in some sort of petroleum-based car. I'm on a bicycle like a free spirit. And so I'm very safety conscious, and my helmet, they recommend new bike helmet about every 5 years. Mine is starting to kind of, the adjusting thing is starting falling loose. So I'm like, I need a new bike helmet. They sell, this week on Touch of Modern, they're selling bike helmets.
Perfect.
Really nice, high-end, like $100 bike helmets that are on sale for like $65, $70. $54, some for $43. Guess who's getting a new bike helmet from Touch of Modern? I'm getting the orange one for $32. I bet you a lot of people don't want to buy that one, but I'm crazy safe.
Well, it won't sell out.
That's right. No one's going to buy them. I buy it because I wear bright colored clothing.
So. Yeah, you do. You wear an orange jumpsuit when you ride your bike.
Yeah, and lasers. I shoot lasers out of my face. That's how I ride around my bicycle. So that's the thing about Touch of Modern. Everything. I've now bought a pair of shoes.
Well, they might also have lasers. if you check.
They better. I bought a pair of shoes, I bought insoles, and now I'm going to get a bike helmet.
Nice. So touchofmodern.com, you get immediate access when you sign up, and it's really cool. The stuff changes, and it's a lot of really cool stuff. I have to say, I really been enjoying like the artwork. I like that those superhero Rorschach drawings. I bought like a cool landscape that we'll put in the bedroom, and then there was some great Star Wars art they had a little while back. Every week, there's like some different cool artwork.
It's such a cool thing, and like I see why this site. It's intriguing because you want to keep going.
You want to keep going to see, well, what do they have next?
Like, even if they weren't a sponsor, I would be going back every week because I'm like, well, I want to see what
kind of survival knife do they have this time?
Why wouldn't just buy one? You talk about survival.
I know, I do. I should just buy one. I'm very curious about them. Like, because they seem to have, there seems to be different levels of survivor knife.
Oh, so, solar powered, compass filled, lunatic.
Like, there's definitely got to be a get off my lawn one.
There's got to be I'm hoping for an apocalypse.
Yeah, exactly. I already have my cabin. So all I need is my knife.
There's no rules. I can kill people.
So touchofmodern.com. Everything you need to live your life out in a cabin in the woods.
with a helmet and nice shoes.
Yes.
So again, if you refer a friend, you get $20. And then they get 10. So it's a great way. So
everyone
refer
wins.
Two friends, you can get yourself a new bike helmet.
Nice.
Or one of these crazy knives Chris wants to go hunt with. Wingbird. All right, well, let's go back into some...
touchofmodern.com.
So let's go back into some other cult films.
Yes.
Like, here is...
Let's talk about Sam Raimi's trilogy. The Evil Dead, Evil Dead 2, and of course, Army of Darkness. Now, these had to be an influence on
I
you
love
as well.
Them, of course. Mm-hmm. Huge influence. I love them all.
What I love, too, is the way they genre hop.
Yeah, like, I love that, too.
You know, the first one is a balls-out, scary horror movie.
Terrifying. Absolutely.
Absolutely terrifying. And they re-released it, too, with digital surround sound. And I watched that at home, and it's even more terrifying.
I believe it.
And then the second one started introducing a little bit of humor into it. And then
just
like,
a little bit.
Just a little bit, but it's still kind of scary. And then even Sam Raimi said the third one's more of an action movie, or an adventure movie.
Sure,
yeah, because
sure.
It's not, third one's not scary at all, but it's so much fun. It's absolutely hilarious. And I could not be more excited for Ash versus the Evil Dead coming
you
up.
You and me both. I can't wait. It's going to be so fun.
When we were
so
at Comic-Con, they were giving away foam chainsaws that actually said Ash versus the Evil Dead on.
Dude, this is what I love. I love especially Sam Raimi, but when horror movies in general have a sense of humor about them.
Yes.
I love that.
And their promotion, and then the shit they do down at Comic-Con.
Right,
just
it was
like,
great.
It's fun.
It's what it should be.
The people who love scary movies, the real fans, I speak from experience because I'm one of them, it's fun to be scared. The experience is part of the fun.
It's the roller coaster aspect.
It's the roller coaster aspect. So to have a sense of humor about oneself, even when they're promoting a very scary movie, is all part of it. You know, I agree.
That's cool.
And what are some of the cult horror movies that you enjoy?
Well, I love those. Yeah. Of course. Absolutely. My first love was monster movies. And then that eventually evolved into a love of all kinds of movies. But I mean, when I was very, very young, my first love initially it was the Universal monster movies, Frankenstein, Dracula, Wolfman. I got my biggest film education, my first big film education, I should say, from Svengoolie.
Oh, yeah.
Svengoolie, for those who don't know, is, and he's still doing it.
Really?
He's on MeTV still to this day. If you watch it here in LA, and I do on Saturday nights, right? He's still doing it. Rich Coase is still playing Svengoolie. And he's a local horror show host who shows scary movies and then between the commercial breaks does shtick and jokes. And he's also a huge influence on me with respect to his comedy. He was a great joke writer, a great punster, just a great funny guy. Anyway, but on Son of Svengoolie, I watched, first time I ever saw all the original Universal monster movies, all the Hammer horror films, all the Japanese Giant Monster on the Rampage movies. The first time I ever saw the AIP drive-in, you know, sci-fi and horror classics, I saw all of them on Svengoolie.
Yeah. He educated our whole generation.
Exactly.
Like all of us at our age group, we turned on to those movies because they all came out obviously before we were born, most of them. And we were all, and the thing I liked about it, because I was
every kid, area had one too.
Every area had one.
Yeah. Because we had them in Philly. We had the, you know, we had like Stella, and I think there was a couple other ones that would do that. They would introduce the monster movies.
Yeah.
And the thing that was so great about it is, I was a kid, I got scared easily, but I liked it because he would always, it would make it funny. It would release the tension for me as a kid, because sometimes I'd be like, I can't handle this. And then he'd come on with some crazy quick joke.
And it was hilarious.
Yeah. And it was just, it was silly. The fact that it was like bad quality, like it was just some one camera and some shitty light, like that actually was like, oh, this is cool. I just feels like some weird guy in his basement telling me about, you know, it's like a garage sale or something like that.
You can only afford one camera in the studio.
No.
Literally.
Second, yeah. Literally. There was no second angle. There was. Right. I don't even think they did close-ups typically. Like, it was just like there was one guy. You could just picture like one guy just sitting there smoking cigarettes, reading a comic book, just periodically looking up going, man, I guess everything's still running. Like the lights are still on.
He's the guy throwing the rubber chickens from off camera.
Yeah, that's what it was. I couldn't believe that it was one of the first times I think it was, that helped influence me to be a comedian.
I believe it.
Because I was watching an adult, because me and my brother and my sister, you know, my parents were theater people, so we had this giant wood cabinet in our basement that had all these wigs and costumes, and so we're always doing plays and playing dress up. And I was like, I thought that was only for kids. And here's this guy in dumb, bad wig and makeup, you know, just goop. I was like, he's
acting like... No, adults get paid for it.
Like, I know. I was like, so you can act like a kid your whole life and make money from this?
That's great.
And introduce, you know, movies that are kind of cheesy, some of them, but are cool or whatever. Like, I was like...
That was, a lot of people don't know now. That was a big thing from the 50s on.
30 years later, you're in a garage doing just that.
I'm particularly at work and I'm wearing flip-flops.
Yeah.
I guess you could say the most famous national one would have been Elvira.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. Right. Elvira, right. Yeah. Which again was funny.
Sure.
I mean, obviously she'd rope you to come for the boobs but stay for the jokes
right,
or whatever.
Right.
But that was part of the whole vibe, man.
So yeah, so I loved them all. And then eventually that evolved into a love of all kinds of movies. The first movie that I saw that really was an awakening for me, that film was more than just fun monsters and scary things, that it could actually change the way you look at life and the world, was when I saw One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Oh,
and that
man.
Movie blew my mind, and I cried in it. You know, I mean, and I thought to myself, you know, and I watched it over and over again, and I just couldn't get enough of the idea that this movie changed the way I looked at the world. And then that opened my eyes to a whole new way of looking at film, and then I just became this sponge. I would just watch every kind of movie that I could possibly get my hands on.
That's interesting that was one of your kind of gateway movies, because if you watch that movie and you don't have the reference of these other movies, you're probably thinking like, wait, they can't end a movie like this.
That's true.
There's no way.
That's a great point, watching this film as a kid. And again, when I was like, 10, 11, 12, like from like 11 to 18, I was living in Chicago, and that's when the VHS thing started.
Sure.
And this video store opened up, Video Sonic. And that's when all of these amazing movies from the 60s and 70s, I got to watch them for the first time at home alone on the TV. You know, I was single parent, you know, my parents were divorced. So I was a latchkey kid. And that was, to me, when I went, my kid was like, what, you can't just have a guy run off and throw a sink through a wall and that's it. And then like would watch it again and again. And like, as I got, like, wow, that is amazing. That is an amazing story.
Absolutely. And it's true. The movies that changed my life when I saw them all for the first time too, the same way, alone on a small television on VHS. That's where I saw Taxi Driver for the first time.
Yeah, oh my God.
And you had to go and return the videos back to the video store.
It's true. You had to. That's where I saw The French Connection for the first time. That's where I saw Harold and Maude for the first time. That's where I saw Clockwork Orange for the first time. You know what I mean? And And there were also theaters in Chicago.
Sure.
Revival theaters that I'd see a lot of cool old movies at. There was one called The Parkway, one called The Varsity, one called The Music Box.
Varsity Music Box.
Yeah, those were awesome.
Oh, God.
So, like, so many great movies there.
So many great. That's the first time I saw Apocalypse Now footage on the big screen. Was when I was in my early 20s and the Hearts of Darkness documentary came out.
Great.
And I saw that at the music, or no, the Art House. The what's the one on Michigan Avenue? The
Fine Arts. Yeah.
And I had only seen Apocalypse Now on VHS.
Yeah.
And I was at the Fine Arts Theater and they intercut the actual, you know, some footage from Apocalypse Now, the helicopter scene. And I, like, my whole body started shaking because I was like, oh, that movie was powerful on a TV.
Sure.
And then the first time I saw that foot, just part of the footage in the documentary.
Mind blowing.
I was like.
You know, it's funny you should say that because I first saw the Godfather on VHS.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. Alone in a room on a small television. Right. Right. Loved it. Right. Watched it over and over. But then I did see the Godfather. I think it was at the Varsity. Right. And that was the first time I had seen it. I had seen it many times on VHS, but then when I saw it for the first time on the big screen, that I remember, it's so funny you should bring this up, that was the first time I realized seeing a movie on a big screen, the experience is so much more dramatic, so much more different. The scene where Michael Corleone is going to kill the cop in the Italian restaurant, the tension that that scene builds when you're watching it on a big screen, and you're totally immersed, is so much more powerful than when I saw it on the VHS, you know?
Right.
You can see his lip sweat.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You can see him going and you know, and the cop who's just dumb and doesn't get what's going on, and the other Italian guy's like looking sideways out of his eyes at Michael Corleone.
And then he's got the gun on him, right? He's taking it out of the bathroom. You know he's got it on him and he's going to do it or isn't he going to do it? And then this is the first time too also that I realized how important sound was in a movie because there's... That the tension is built so beautifully in that scene, and then there, the train goes by as the camera cranes down into him, and it's so powerful.
And that's so funny. One of the complaints that a lot of filmmakers had too is like a lot of the sound gets lost in the transfer to VHS.
Totally. Yeah, of course.
I mean, you have you know now with digital sound, it's the experience at home is way different than when you were watching a VHS tape.
Oh, and, I saw those movies with the speaker that I saw them on. It was like it was no better than a little transistor radio.
Right.
Speaker.
Okay.
I
mean, yeah.
13 or 14 inch, maybe 15 inch color TV with one of those little speakers that you're talking about.
Yeah, that was in the TV and it was that was it. It was like right under the knob.
Like talking through a glass.
Like, and it's so powerful because I want to go back to One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest because I want to talk about Milos Forman because you had then Hair, you had Ragtime, you had Amadeus, which were like, I remember watching Ragtime in the theater. I was actually old enough to see that in the theater. Mm-hmm. And visually, that's not like his most amazing piece of work.
But it's a beautiful film.
It's still a beautiful film. I saw that in the big screen and I was like 10, 11 years old and went, wow.
Yeah, beautiful.
The visual poetry of the big screen.
At 10, I would imagine Elizabeth McGovern naked was probably a lot of
fat on the big screen. Was wonderful.
Yep.
Still, Elizabeth McGovern, that's, oh God, you just said that. I just saw her in something and I still went, oh.
Yeah.
Like, is that my 11-year-old self? Remember when you saw her naked in Ragtime? When my parents were taking me to movies, I was way too young to be watching.
Me too.
All right. Well,
the internet doesn't forget.
Let's do any couple more before we wrap it up.
Well, there's so many great movies on this list. I mean, come on, these movies are all great. 12 Monkeys is great. Buckaroo Banzai. Oh.
I'm going to mention one that is a terrible film, but it has a weird place in my heart, and I can't even really explain why. Krull. Now, this movie is absolutely awful, and even if you try to watch it again, you'll have trouble getting through it. But for some reason, I'm mesmerized by it every single time. It has these giant, bloated sci-fi spectacle sets. It has crazy tight pants for no reason, and a lot of the actors. It has Liam Neeson in it, and Robbie Coltrane. No, it's what's his name? From the place Hagrid in the Harry Potter movies.
No,
I can't remember his name now. Everyone is now going, it's blah, blah, blah.
Here's the list.
Rick Kroll. It's,
Well, this is compelling audio.
No, I don't even think he might have been listed on the, he wasn't even in that list, but he wasn't in it for very long. It was all these actors that would then get bigger or in this like one gang of like thugs that you barely see.
Yeah.
And, because a lot of the leads you never saw again.
Sure, sure.
But it was
directed by Peter Yates, who did he did Breaking Away. He did Eyewitness.
Yeah, it's an interesting choice.
Like,
yeah.
Was it that time when like, oh, sci-fi is big.
Yeah,
you,
yeah.
And just, that's exactly what it was.
A ton of money was thrown at this film, and it was all wasted, pretty much.
Totally.
Because it was one of those movies that was a mess from start to finish. If you really want to see a movie that's a mess, like, it couldn't decide, is it science fiction? Is it fantasy? Is it a romance? Right. Is it... how much special effects are we going to put in? Doesn't matter. Put in more. You know, there's...
Well, listen, we all, I think, have movies that are our guilty pleasures.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And there's also something to be said for seeing a movie at a particular time, at a particular, at an impressionable age, where you just have an innate nostalgia connected to that movie forever, you know?
But it's weird about this movie is I know how bad it is, and yet, at least with a lot of movies, you feel that way, you still kind of enjoy them.
Sure.
But this one, I don't even really...
Is this like eating a frozen pizza?
Yeah, it's exactly what it is.
This is I'm shitty, but it's great.
But I can't stop eating it. Yeah, exactly.
I can understand that.
I'm going to pour Tabasco on it because it's so shitty.
That's very funny.
Well, what's a guilty pleasure for you, Adam?
That's a great question because, you know, there are movies that I can definitely say are not good movies, but I don't feel guilty about liking them. I mean, I've been asked that question before and I don't have a go-to answer for it.
Mm-hmm.
What's a guilty pleasure for me? You know, I'll tell you the guilty pleasure for me just off the top of my head is the show Kung Fu. that's my go-to guilty pleasure, I have to say, because if you watch those now...
Can I just interrupt for a second? It was Robbie Coltrane.
If you watch Kung Fu now, I mean, I loved that show as a kid. It's not a great show.
Right.
But I still love it, even though it's not a great show, you know?
Well, the thing about that show is, especially when you watch it as an adult now.
Yeah.
You go, God, I see what they were trying to do.
Sure, totally.
They're trying to impart all these wonderful, like, Buddhist kung fu messages through the, network TV. Like, it's like you can just imagine Ned Beatty and Robert Duvall's character from Network, dealing with this TV show.
Totally, like, totally.
And it's also that, you remember the from the movie Dragon about Bruce Lee,
totally.
About how he was supposed to play that part, and he got screwed over. You can see all that knowledge. You watch it now, you go, wow! But there's still amazing moments in that movie. The flashback scenes,
great.
Where his head shaved at the Shaolin Temple.
Totally. And, but I also have something beyond the obvious stuff that I connect to that movie because of when I saw it and what I associate with it when I watch it now. It takes me back to a different age, and so there's a comfort and nostalgia factor there.
Yes.
That if I were to show that show to somebody who'd never seen it before, who's, I don't know, 20 years old now, they'd say, what the hell are you talking about? You know, but I think there's a lot of that. I remember I saw, I've seen great directors always talk about, great movies, that movies are really influential to them. And sometimes they're great movies, like when Martin Scorsese talks about Peeping Tom. It's like, that's a cool movie. Mm-hmm. But then there's a lot of filmmakers.
Maltese Falcon.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. But then there's a lot of movies that filmmakers will cite as great films, and you'll watch them and you'll say, this is a terrible film. What are they talking about? And what they left out of their conversation was, I saw it at a time, at an age, when it had it left an impression on me. And now when I see it, it harkens me back to that time. There's something different about that. And we all have those,
It's
definitely
funny. I do that with like The Natural.
Mm-hmm.
I saw that in the theater. I was 14 or 15 when it came out, and I went with my mom and stepdad, and it was a crowded Saturday night, so I had to sit alone. So they were like, well, we're going to, we found two seats. There's not three seats together. And I was like, fine, I'll go sit by myself.
Yeah.
And sat alone in this crowded theater and had this such an emotional response.
Yeah.
That now whenever I hear that music, I go back to that. I go back to what that, what, how I reacted to that movie, how, you know, for the first 15, 20 years after seeing, I would watch it once a year. It's like one of those movies, like, ah, I just need to have a natural night.
Yeah.
And you know, I've heard some people, like, I mean, we've had Alan Havey on the show, and he was mad because they changed the ending of the Bernard Malamud book and all this other stuff. And I'm like, normally I would be on board with that, but I just...
Doesn't matter.
Yeah. Because that moment in my life, it influenced me so much.
Totally. Absolutely.
Right.
Well, let's...
You know what? Let's before we wrap up, let's just mention Adam's new movie.
Yeah, that's what I want to find. Yeah, yeah. Tell us about the director's cut and what's the status of this.
Sure. Mm-hmm. So I am in the process of finishing a film right now called Director's Cut. Picture's locked. Score is mixed. We're finalizing color correction as we speak. It's almost done. And interesting tidbit about this movie is it was written by Penn Jillette of Penn & Teller. Usually I write my own films that I direct, mm-hmm. but this one was written by Penn Jillette. And it was entirely crowdfunded.
Oh, yeah.
And we it's a very unusual film. So we knew that we wouldn't get funding through the traditional channels. So Penn has a very large fan base. And he's got 2 million Twitter followers. Wow. And he's very actively involved with them all. You know, he answers every tweet. And he talks back and forth with his fans all the time. So we decided, let's try and get this film funded through crowdfunding, and it worked. And
we raised
over $1 million.
That is unbelievable.
Yeah, yeah. And so we have
no one's happier about that than Kickstarter.
Exactly. No, they love it, man.
Absolutely.
Like,
yeah, absolutely.
They set up the best. Yep. And this is the new technology, the new economy is set up a business that helps people and you get a taste.
Yeah, of course.
Exactly.
Absolutely. You know, everybody wins. Kickstarter makes money.
Yeah.
You guys get this cool thing. Yeah. The fans get cool.
Yeah, whatever, you can make the movie now.
DVDs.
You can make the movie. Absolutely.
So tell us what it's about.
Okay, it's a very warped, dark comedy, and it's about a stalker who's obsessed with an actress. So she happens to be starring in a film that was crowdfunded. So this stalker obtains access to her set by buying the all access pass to the set. package on the crowdfunding site, and while he's on the set, he kidnaps her and brings her back to his home dungeon studio, movie studio, where he attempts to reshoot the rest of the movie, starring himself as her new romantic lead. He then takes all the footage from the movie that she was making and all the footage that he shot, and he mashes it all together into this insane fan edit that is his quote-unquote director's cut. And so what you're seeing is his cut of the movie, and it's all narrated with his director's commentary track.
That sounds... So it's like, it's kind of thriller, comedy.
So you're saying no one would fund that? Is that...
I believe it or not.
I would have thought the Weinsteins would have just given you $20 million on the spot.
It was a very... It's a very unusual film, and... But, I mean, thanks to all our fantastic donors, we were able to make this very bizarre film.
And that's so great.
Yeah, and it turned out great.
So what's the plan for it?
Well, what we want to do is, as you know, it's entirely made independently because it's crowdfunded.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to premiere it at a cool film festival and do the film festival route for a while and see if we can sell it to a distributor. You know, I mean, ideally, it's the... I believe it's the kind of movie that... A distributor, when they see an audience react to it, they'll get it, and then they'll want to buy it. But if you screen it for them alone in their screening room, they'll not get it.
They won't get it.
Because it's so weird, you know? Yeah. I mean, speaking of influences, one of the movies that influenced this movie was a little bit of The King of Comedy.
I was just going to say, that's what it sounds like. Yeah. It sounds like Rupert Pupkin kind of stuff.
His character is very Rupert Pupkin-esque. Penn plays the stalker, but he doesn't play him as this scary character. He plays him as this more sort of lovable, creepy sissy, and he took inspiration from Tiny Tim for the character.
Oh.
but the Rupert Pupkin idea was definitely present when we were making the... I mean, you know what? I wouldn't even say that this is a movie that I particularly love, but it's also a little bit like Bowfinger. It's like the King of Comedy meets Bowfinger. You know what I mean? We're kind of a little bit of the influences, but it's also unlike anything you've seen. It's very unique.
Well, that's great. Very cool. I hope the distribution happens, and whenever happens down the road, we sell movies on our site. So if you want to, come here, we'll be happy to help.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Well, I'd love you guys to see it nonetheless. So whenever we have a screening, I'll invite
you guys. Awesome. Please do. Yeah. We'll talk it up.
Cool, man.
We'll talk
thanks.
The shit out of
cool.
That's so awesome.
Can't wait to see it now.
That's awesome. So, all right, guys, that's our episode. That was fun. That went fast.
Yeah, it was really cool. Well, Adam, where else can people find you on the internet?
Everybody can find me on Twitter at Adam Rifkin. I, like Penn, will answer every tweet.
Nice.
Unless I find it thoroughly embarrassing.
Yeah.
I'm also on Facebook, and I think I'm at my limit. I can't accept more friends, but people can follow me there or write me a private message there. But Twitter is probably the best place.
Cool.
At Adam Rifkin.
Guys, check out all of his movies if you haven't already. And
especially Dark Backward, if you want to go see in his archive.
Thank you very much.
Really and definitely check out Shooting the Warwicks, which just came out.
All right, guys, that's our episode. Put it in the books. Don't forget Los Angeles Podcast Festival, September 18th through the 20th.
Yes, coming up.
We're doing a little preview night on the September 17th at the Hollywood Improv. We're going to just have a couple live podcasts there. We'll announce that lineup soon.
And your pass will get you in, though, your weekend pass.
Your weekend pass. You're basically just getting an extra little bonus night.
Right.
If you live in the LA area, you can come to that show and buy your weekend pass there if you'd like.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, if you can't make it out to LA, you can buy a live video stream. Normally it's $25, but if you use coupon code CFN for $20, you get to see every show live over the weekend, and then they archive for 3 weeks after.
Yes.
So the coupon code is how you help the show, guys. So go to lapodfest.com. All right, you guys, thank you so much for listening. Thank you to our guest, Adam Rifkin.
Yeah, thank you, guys.
That was great.
This is a really great episode. I love talking cult movies.
Oh, this is awesome. We've never talked about cult movies before.
We're going to save this list and just do another episode.
This is a great list, man. I'm going to take this list home. Rock and Roll High School, come on.
That's a great one.
Very cool.
We got to do another one of these. We didn't even get close to half of these.
No, not at all. It's like three pages.
All right, guys, thank you so much for listening. My name is Graham Elwood.
And I'm Chris Mancini. And as always, remember,
Han shot first.
Not a cult film.